convincing yourself that you are going to take that next step, that you are in pre-production, I think is a challenge. Yeah.
I think you make the film, honestly. I think your performance is really what I took away as like the strongest thing. But in
so being, you're the one.
Yeah, being the writer, the producer, the star, was there ever a moment where you were like, oh, God, I want to just be nice. Maybe it just suck.
Yeah. Everyone, like our DP, Aaron Torres, you know, people weren't afraid to give me advice. I remember Ben Atkinson, who was our script supervisor. We had only three takes to do the car scene with Maddie, and I played the first two takes a little too light, a little too late in John's journey, I guess you could say. And he said, look, man, I never really say anything, but I really think John's not there yet. Maybe you can take it down for this third one. And I gave it a shot, and that is the take, for the most part, that we used throughout that whole scene. So it was definitely a difficult... I forgot your question. A difficult...
Everyone does. Right?
Sorry.
Where do you fall on the Kinsey scale?
I fell off. It really depends. Most of the time, I just like to consider myself in the middle. I tend to date girls, but it's a day-to-day thing, man.
What do you want audiences to take away from this?
That sexuality is not black and white.
This has been a conversation with Jesse Rosen, writer, director, producer, and now movie star. The Art of Being Straight is a Regent release. I'm Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
You like boys, but you don't understand. You like girls, well, give yourself a big hand. You go down, but then you come back again. Uh-oh, uh-oh, which way do you go?
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. This week, Michael LeBeau, John Torres, Rex Walkner with Bill Kelly, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Thanks also to Free Speech Radio News and reporter Karen Miller. Paxton performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is underwritten in part by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through donations from our listeners. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to support our work, hear our podcasts, or subscribe to CDs of our programs. To receive our weekly program email alerts, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on KRCC, Colorado Springs, Colorado, to ECR, Eden, New South Wales, Grateful Dread Radio, Baltimore, Maryland, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
And this community radio station is 89.5 FM WPKN Bridgeport, 88.7 FM WPKM Montauk. It's 8 o'clock.
Folk artists The Kennedys, Caroline Doctorow, and Barbara Lamb will take the stage at the Hamptons Roots Music Festival on Saturday, June 27th at 7 p.m. The festival, a benefit for WPKN and WPKM, will be held at the Levitas Center for the Arts at the Southampton Cultural Center, 25 Pond Lane in Southampton, New York. Reserved tickets for the Hamptons Roots Music Festival are $25 each for general seating and $10 for children. Call the festival hotline at 631-687-9040 or email rootsmusicfest@gmail.com. Call for tickets at 631-687-9040 or email rootsmusicfest@gmail.com.
Light the lava lamp. Here comes the concert you've been waiting for. The Electric Prunes, Love, with Johnny Eccles and Baby Lemonade, and Sky Sunlight Saxon of the Seeds. Turn the clock back to the music of California in 1966. Hear the music that started it all in a one-time live show, as only the people that created it can present. This is not a tribute or a copy. This is the real thing. Electric Prunes. Love. Sky Sunlight Saxon. California 66. This may be your last chance.
California 66 is a benefit concert for WPKN Radio on Thursday, August 6th at the Quick Center, Fairfield University, Fairfield, Connecticut. Tickets are available online at quickcenter.com or through the box office at 203-254-4010. Benefit tickets are $66 for adults and $33 for students and are tax deductible to the extent allowed.
This Friday night, it's a benefit concert for WPKN at the Fairfield Theater Company with Equinox. Tickets are $17. To purchase your tickets online, go to WPKN.org or call the Fairfield Theater Company's box office, 203-259-1036. Again, that's 203-259-1036. That's Equinox this Friday night at the Fairfield Theater Company in a benefit concert for WPKN. For more information, visit WPKN.org. I hope to see you there. Rockin' shoes and show us your cans. It's a benefit concert for WPKN and a food drive for Strangers Helping Strangers. Friday, July 10th at the Acoustic Cafe featuring the Juicy Grapes.
Isn't that the way love is meant to be? Hand in hand so easily. Well, it takes some work to see things through.
That's Friday, July 10th at the Acoustic Cafe. Admission is $5. The Acoustic Cafe is at 2926 Fairfield Avenue in the Black Rock section of Bridgeport. Please bring a non-perishable food item for Strangers Helping Strangers. Save the date, and I hope to see you there.
I think we got something started.
Folk artists The Kennedys, Caroline Doctorow, and Barbara Lamb will take the stage at the Hamptons Roots Music Festival on Saturday, June 27th at 7 p.m. The festival, a benefit for WPKN and WPKM, will be held at the Levitas Center for the Arts at the Southampton Cultural Center, 25 Pond Lane in Southampton, New York. Folk duo The Kennedys have won consistent critical and audience acclaim for their tight harmonies, clever lyrics, and energetic compositions.
If I dare to ask a question and expect an answer true, it's only because I ask it of myself as well as you. When I extract confessions and I do it very well, the handcuffs are precautions to protect you from yourself, 'cause I don't trust words.
Singer-songwriter Caroline Doctorow's latest release, Another Country, the songs of Mimi and Richard Farina, has garnered critical acclaim and has remained on the top of the folk music airplay charts since its release in October 2008.
Now roll.
Caroline Doctorow's music was featured in a PBS History special hosted by Katie Couric. She is also known for her interpretation of songs by Bob Dylan. Nashville fiddler Barbara Lamb has released 5 albums on the Sugar Hill label and has toured and performed with artists as diverse as Trisha Yearwood, Ranch Romance, Asleep at the Wheel, the Laura Love Band, and the John Cowan Band. Reserve tickets for the Hamptons Roots Music Festival are $25 each for general seating and $10 for children. Call the festival hotline at 631-687-9040 or email rootsmusicfest@gmail.com. Tickets at the door, if available, are $30. Call for tickets at 631-687-9040 or email rootsmusicfest@gmail.com. Mark your calendar for the Hamptons Roots Music Festival on Saturday, June 27th at 7 p.m. at the Levitas Center for the Arts, 25 Pond Lane in Southampton, New York. A benefit for WPKN and WPKN.
This is 89.5 FM, WPKN Bridgeport, 88.7 FM, WPKN Montauk, and this is Counterpoint. I'm Ebong Udama, sitting in for the vacation in Scott Harris, who will be back with you next Monday at the same time. We're going to be talking about Iran in just a few minutes, and we'll be getting an update from Robert Naiman, who's a senior policy analyst and a national coordinator of Just Foreign Policy. And we will be doing that in just about in the next 5 minutes or so. So stay right by your radio. It's a Monday night. This is 89.5 FM, WPKN Bridgeport, Counterpoint. Jeb E. Saba, La Cajina Remix. This is 89.5 FM WPKN Bridgeport, 88.7 FM WPKM Montauk. And right now we are going to focus our attention on the goings-on in Iran. And the latest out of Tehran right now is that Iranian riot police have fired tear gas to break up a new opposition rally in the center of the capital, Tehran, hours after a stern warning to protesters. Some 1,000 people had gathered despite the warning from Iran's Revolutionary Guards against holding unapproved rallies. Basij militiamen wielding clubs were brought in to reinforce the police. The guards, an elite armed force, vowed to crack down on new street protests over the presidential election results. And on Friday, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei banned protests, prompting street violence in which at least 10 people died. Severe reporting restrictions have been placed on Western news media and other foreign media in Iran. So protest reports cannot be verified independently, although eyewitnesses said hundreds of riot police were used to drive the protesters from the square. On Monday afternoon, a police helicopter could be seen circling above the center of Tehran. We're now joined by Robert Naiman, who was with us last week, talking about the elections in Iran. And good evening, Robert.
Good evening.
Hi, how are you? Could you give us a brief update? What's the situation right now? What's your take? What are your sources telling you about what's going on in Iran right now?
Well, as you said, the in the last few days, a window closed. If you recall, you know, it's now more than a week has passed since the election. In the early days after the election, there were protests by the opposition camp, which were largely tolerated by the government. And the central appeal of the protesters was to Supreme Leader Khamenei and to the Guardian Council to overturn one way or another the election result. And in particular, as time wore on, the demand crystallized of calling for an entirely new election. On Friday, Supreme Leader Khamenei in the Friday sermon closed the door by saying that while there no doubt were irregularities, and we're going to ask the Guardian Council to investigate them, we're certainly not going to overturn the election or hold the new election, and the protest should stop, as you say. And furthermore, if they don't stop, they're going to be suppressed. I mean, said in so many words, everybody understood that to be the signal. Recall that prior to that, even though the government had not given permits for some of the opposition rallies, the opposition rallies had happened anyway, and the government had largely left them alone. But there was a shift towards the end of last week, as you referred to in your introduction, where the government said, okay, we're not going to tolerate this anymore, and there's going to be consequences. And not surprisingly, as a result of that, the turnout was much lower for the protests on Saturday, and the confrontation was more violent. It had been reported that several people were killed, 10 according to the government, 19 according to some opposition sources. Nobody knows outside knows exactly for sure. Another thing that the government has done is sharply restricted foreign press reporting. The chief BBC permanent correspondent in Tehran was ordered to leave the country. Many press passes have been revoked and foreign media have been prevented from reporting. So the reports coming out now are often eyewitness accounts, things that people are posting on Twitter or on YouTube, and this gives you some kind of sense, but of course it's hard to tell exactly, you know, somebody posts a video, where is this video from, when it's from, you know, what does it mean? It's much harder to judge. But in broad measure, we can say obviously what's going on, that some level of protest is continuing to, despite government crackdown. Some investigation of the results of the election has taken place, but it has come to the conclusion, perhaps not surprisingly, that whatever irregularities there were on June 12th did not affect the overall result. I say not surprisingly for two reasons. One, of course, the people doing the investigation are not some, you know, completely independent, neutral body. This is the Guardian Council, which is part of the state apparatus, includes many people loyal to, presumably politically loyal to the Supreme Leader Khamenei and to President Ahmadinejad, but also because it's really not at all clear that the, to me at least, and to many other observers, that the election was stolen. It's one thing to say that there were isolated incidents of fraud. That would be true of any election in the United States, any presidential election in the United States. The question was, the question in terms of the fundamental legitimacy of the election is, was there fraud so widespread on such a scale as to have changed the election result? At least that's the question. If you want to claim that the election was stolen, that would be the thing you would have to give evidence for.
Okay. Now, what about the fact that the election's results were announced so soon after balloting had finished, and considering that this had to be pretty much, there were written in ballots that had to be manually counted, and to count, I believe it was about 8 million ballots that were counted. And the results started about a couple of hours after the polls closed. They already were giving out results, and I understand from the reports at the time that many polling places had to stay open a bit later because there was a backlog, and they didn't have enough ballots for everyone that wanted to cast a vote.
Yeah, there's a couple of things there. First of all, of course, you know, polls stay open late in the United States, too, when there are people in line waiting to vote. And particularly in a high turnout election, there's nothing spectacular, you know, particularly spectacular about that at all. Secondly, it's not true, you know, when people say, oh, my God, how is it that they announced the results so soon after the polls closed? They did not announce, they announced preliminary results after a few hours after the official closing time. So some polls were still open, but the majority of polls had closed on time. So they had quite a few ballots. And if you look at the press reports from the time, they didn't say Friday night, okay, well, we've counted all the votes, and here's the result. They said, we've counted some of the results, the votes, and this is the result that we expect. And then, you know, Saturday morning they gave another count, and later on Saturday they gave another count. So there isn't, so that's not, the fact that they announced the preliminary result is not at all surprising. And the, well, maybe it was, maybe the announcement was surprising, but that they, that on the basis of not having counted all the votes, they were able to make a prediction about the outcome, that's not surprising. That happens, you know, again, in U.S. elections. So the, as far as, like, counting the votes quickly, it's true that they had paper ballots. On the other hand, they have a lot of election workers. In Canada, they have paper ballots, and they counted them in a few hours. Remember, also, unlike a presidential election in the United States, where you have, you know, you go in to vote, you vote for president, you vote for governor, you vote for senator, there's a lot of things. In this election, there was just one question on the ballot. So that can be counted a lot quicker when there's just one question on the ballot than when there are many different questions on the ballot and even people facing different jurisdictions facing different questions. So that in itself, the fact that they were able to give a preliminary result after several hours of counting ballots and that the final result wasn't fundamentally different from the initial result, again, that's what you would expect because if the first set of ballots that you count are at all representative, if they're not a very skewed sample, then you would expect that the initial result would not be fundamentally very different from the final result. So it's the same thing that happens in U.S. elections where they call an election, you know, with 60% of the vote
from the projections.
You're calling this election for, yeah, you make a projection. What enables you to make that projection? If there's a significant margin between the two candidates, so you can say, well, the probability of the second guy making this up is really small because there's a big gap.
Now, could you tell us about the Guardian Council? Because the Guardian Council came out today and said that it found some evidence of voting irregularities, but the number had no effect on the result of the elections. And could you tell us the role of the former president, Rafsanjani, in Iranian politics right now? Because he seems to be coming out as a very prominent figure in what is going on there right now.
He's a very powerful figure for a number of reasons, many sources of power. First of all, he's a very wealthy man. And as we know, everywhere in the world, if you have a lot of money, you know there's a lot of things that you can do. He didn't have a lot of money. He has a lot of influence that comes from his personal wealth. He's from a wealthy family. He has a lot of social connection inside Iran. He's kind of a power broker.
Yeah, I understand that his wealth preceded the 79 revolution.
Yeah, that's another source of influence. And he's part of the generation, you know, one of the founding fathers, if you will, of the generation of the 1979 revolution, as is Khamenei, as is Mr. Mousavi, part of that generation. So he has that credibility of being, you know, part of the family of the founding fathers. He was a presidential candidate in 2005. As you said, he's on the Guardian Council, he's on the Expediency Council. He's very much part of the inside of, you know, of the elite of the regime. Of course, he's within that elite, he's defined by opposition. For many years, he's had a political struggle with Ahmadinejad. He opposed him in the runoff in the 2005 presidential election. They were the two opposing candidates. He's long had friction with Supreme Leader Khamenei. So you can say that for some time, he's been a leader, if you will, of the inside elite opposition. And in this most recent presidential election, he was widely seen, I don't know if there's any dispute about it, as backing Mousavi. That was a vehicle for Rafsanjani trying to defeat Ahmadinejad in the election.
Did Ahmadinejad not attack Rafsanjani personally in the debates? I believe he said he was corrupt and attacked him personally.
He did, and the not only did he say that, but many people in Iran believe it. That's why he said it. I mean, why would Ahmadinejad say that? Because it's a good talking point. One of the dynamics in 2005 runoff was that many people in the reformist camp supported Rafsanjani because those the two choices were Rafsanjani and Ahmadinejad, and they didn't want Ahmadinejad, so they supported Rafsanjani. But at the same time, Rafsanjani has this reputation in Iran of being a corrupt political figure, and that really helped Ahmadinejad win the runoff because Ahmadinejad was seen as a, you know, guy who lives simply, he's, you know, man of the people, doesn't dress fancy, doesn't live in a fancy house, and Robson Downey has seen someone who's, you know, rich, lives very well, is probably ill-gotten gains as a result of connections and so on and so forth. And you could argue that that dynamic contributed to Robson Downey this time deciding, okay, well, I'm not going to run, I'm going to back somebody up. I'm going to back this guy, Mousavi, who doesn't have this, at least as much, maybe he has some reputation, according to some people, as corrupt, but not like Rafsanjani, who has really a big reputation in Iran for being corrupt. So, if you know that background, then you say, then you can see why Ahmadinejad would do that and say, okay, well, I'm running against this Mousavi guy that you don't know anything about, but the real power behind Mousavi is this Rafsanjani guy, this corrupt Rafsanjani guy, who you rejected last time when it ran against each other because you saw that he was corrupt. So it makes perfect sense when you know that, that Ahmadinejad would attack Rafsanjani for corruption in the context of a presidential debate with Mr. Mousavi.
Now, what about, you know, if he is this corrupt figure, I mean, has this reputation for corruption, how do you justify the fact that so many came out in the streets to support Mousavi, and the people were so indignant when they heard the results that were officially announced on Saturday?
Oh, well, I don't think that's mysterious at all. After all, in any election, you have to, you know, or at least most people participating in an election, you choose between the candidates, right? And based on, you know, a balance of things, of which, you know, whether the person is corrupt is just one. I mean, to take a really famous example, notorious example, there was the election some years ago in Louisiana where in the runoff it was Edward Edwards against David Duke. And everybody in Louisiana knew that Edwin Edwards was corrupt. But he was running against David Duke. And in fact, there were bumper stickers, you know, that said, vote for the lizard, not the wizard, or vote for the crook. Vote for the crook. It's important. So, yeah, you know, if you have an election between a guy who's, you know, kind of centrist and very corrupt versus, or has a reputation for being very corrupt, versus somebody who's, you know, totally ideologically opposed to you, you might, any of your politically active person, you might go for the corrupt guy. I mean, if you're a liberal Democrat and George W. Bush is running for re-election and the Democratic candidate is somebody that you see as corrupt, you might be like, well, okay, I'm going to hold my nose and vote for the corrupt guy because I care about, you know, civil liberties and abortion rights and so on and so forth, and I'll just hold my nose. So there's a similar dynamic there. Just because people were supporting, many people are supporting Mousavi. I think, you know, this is uncontroversial statement. Many people were supporting Mousavi because they saw him as the alternative to Ahmadinejad, just like in 2005. Many people supported Rafsanjani because they saw him as the alternative to Ahmadinejad.
Mm-hmm. Now, how do you explain, there's something else that people are talking about, and that is the fact that Mousavi barely won in his home state, and I believe in some parts of the state of the region that he's from, he actually lost to Ahmadinejad. How do you explain that, considering the ethnic bonds that are at play in many of these elections?
Yeah. Well, first of all, let me say it's not my position that the election was legitimate or free and fair. It's only my position that people should be cautious about asserting as fact, like everybody knows the election was stolen, when that hasn't been proven. We ought to reserve judgment. And, of course, even if the election wasn't stolen, there's legitimate questions you could ask about, well, suppose there wasn't any fraud at all. This is still a free and fair election, given that, you know, in the Islamic system, they have there's all these constraints. That's a whole other question. I'm just saying that we shouldn't take as automatic fact the claim that the election was stolen, that many of the arguments that people are making are not nearly so obvious. And this one that you cite now is a good example. many people have said and written, oh, how could it be that Mousavi would lose in the province of Azerbaijan? How could it be that he would lose the city of Tabriz when this is his home province, when he himself is Azeri? Well, you know, this poll that Jared Free Tomorrow did 3 weeks before the election addressed this question. Of course, the question didn't exist yet because the election hadn't happened yet. But what they did say, and if you go read in the poll, they said, well, now there's been a lot of commentary in Iran about the fact that here Mousavi is Azeri, and he's going to attract a lot of support from Azeri. We found in our poll that the Azeris we sample, 2-1, they said they were supporting Ahmadinejad. So this just shows that, and of course, if you think about it for a second, it's not automatic. I mean, you could make arguments, well, in the history of Iran, this is the way people have voted, but it's not automatically in the case that people in Azerbaijan or people in Tabriz have to vote for Mousavi. After all, Al Gore lost Tennessee. People don't automatically win their home states or provinces or cities if there are other other issues at stake in the election.
Now, you wrote an article. Basically, I should reintroduce you. We're speaking with Robert Naiman. He's a senior policy analyst and national coordinator at Just Foreign Policy. And he wrote a piece just before the election that was titled, Based on Terror-Free Tomorrow Poll, Ahmadinejad Victory Was Expected. And you are saying here that that your polls that you did polls that were done before the election showed the pattern that has emerged in the official tally that has been released by the Iranian authorities.
What you find if you go look at the thing, and first of all, it should be said, we're operating in the absence of death compared to what would be true, certainly in the United States or even in other countries. Iran doesn't allow international election observers. There is no reliable, rich polling data in Iran like you would have had in the U.S., you know, for many weeks prior to the election. There were polls in Iran. They tended to be either government polls or opposition polls. They weren't random. They weren't all over the country, and so on and so forth. So there is an absence of data. But we do have this poll that was conducted by Western polling firms that have a good track record of doing polling in Muslim-majority countries. And it did find, 3 weeks before the election, that 34% of the people in their sample said that they were going to vote for Ahmadinejad, and 14% of the people in their sample said that they were going to vote for Mousavi. And what's striking about these numbers, when you account for the fact that 15% of the people in the sample didn't vote, because unlike many pre-election polls in the U.S., they didn't screen out for likely voters, who just asked this question of their whole sample because they were polling all kinds of other issues. When you account for that, and then you account for the fact that people say, well, that was 3 weeks before the election. Of course, there was a surge for the opposition. There was a surge for Mousavi. But then you have to ask the question, well, how big? How much? That's at 34 to 14. That's a lot of ground to cover. And even if you assume that 60%, 65%, two-thirds, 70% of the people who are undecided or otherwise unaccounted for, who were voters, who voted in that poll, even if you allocate such a big majority of those people to the opposition, it's still the case that Ahmadinejad would have won in the first round of the election. Now, that doesn't prove that the result announced by the Iranian authorities after June 12th was accurate. It doesn't even prove that Ahmadinejad had a majority in the first round. It does show, I think, that it was quite plausible that Ahmadinejad would have obtained a majority in the first round. And I think it raises the bar for people who are saying that, oh, well, we know the election was stolen. In fact, we have this data that suggests that things were headed in the opposite direction.
Now, basically, it appears. I don't know what the outcome of the deliberations of the Guardian Council, but it seems as if they are validating the election. That there were some irregularities, but generally it was a free and fair election. So where do we move from here? Where do you see things moving in Iran itself?
Yeah, well, those are two different questions. We're depending on who the we is. And I think that for the we of the United States, the most important thing is to stay out. And my concern about people jumping to the people in the U.S., Iranians have the right to think whatever they want, right? It's a democratic right to think that the election was stolen, believe it was stolen, even if it wasn't, and to protest on that basis, even if it's not true. That's, everybody's democratic right to believe whatever they want. But in the United States, we have to think about the future of the U.S. relationship with Iran. Recall that before June 12th, the President of the United States, President Obama, had committed himself to a path of diplomatic engagement with the government of Iran, not as a seal of approval that we like the government of Iran, but that there are issues of conflict between the United States and Iran that we want to resolve diplomatically, right? Because we don't want to have armed conflict. It was not so long ago that the President of the United States, President Bush, was openly threatening military conflict with Iran. And obviously, and it seems to me obvious, that we don't want to see that. Regardless of what you think of the Iranian government, we don't want to see a military conflict between the United States and Iran. Innocent people will be killed, not just in Iran, if there is military hostility. So we want these issues to be resolved diplomatically. The conflict over Iran's nuclear program, the competition for political influence between the United States and Iran in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Lebanon, in Palestine, we want these issues to be resolved diplomatically. In order for them to be resolved diplomatically, they have to be talked between the United States government and the Iranian government. In order to have that process, you have to, in some sense, accept the Iranian government as legitimate, as the legitimate government of Iran. Not that you like them, not that you want to hold them up as a great example of the universe, but they're the government. That's what diplomacy is. It's a relationship between governments,
how easy would it be for President Obama to engage in talks with the Iranian government after what has happened here, considering the domestic political situation here, where he's already being attacked from the Republicans as not being aggressive enough or not being strident enough in his condemning what is going on in Iran, and that it's too weak a response from the White House. It's a sign of weakness, and that is pretty much the line of attack that's going to be that he's going to have to experience domestically if he tries to negotiate with Ahmadinejad at this point.
Well, in the very short run, I think there's no prospect. I mean, until the current situation plays itself out in some sense, there's not going to be much progress. The situation on the ground is still somewhat unsettled in Iran. There are still protests. There's still some kind of division, even within the leadership. That all has not completely played itself out. And I wouldn't expect the Obama administration to do anything dramatic, diplomatically speaking, until that's done. Even then, as you say, there's going to be it's going to be harder in the short run to initiate anything kind of public on diplomacy with Iran. Of course, one can have quiet talks. There's already a framework for different forms of engagement. There's already a process for talking about the nuclear issue involving the Europeans. there's already a process for talking about Afghanistan, for talking about Iraq. And those things are probably not so controversial. It's already routine contact between U.S. and Iranian diplomats has already been authorized. It's hard for me to see, at least at this juncture, there being a tremendous amount of pressure to reverse that. We haven't, you know, there certainly has been repression in Iran. We haven't seen, you know, a huge massacre. And even if there were, God forbid, but even if there were, a Tiananmen, which there hasn't been, and I hope that there won't be, but even if there were, at some point, people would come back around and say, well, what are you going to do? You know, we have these issues. Remember that before all these events, there was heavy pressure from the Israelis on Obama to move quickly on the diplomatic track. You know, they said, okay, we're not really jazzed about this diplomacy thing.
Wasn't there a time?
If you're going to do
there was
it,
a timetable. There wasn't there a timetable that was put in place that Obama accepted that he had to do something before the end of the year, or something had to move on the Iranian side?
There's some, let's say, time frame, because there's some dispute about, you know, whether that was really a deadline or so on. But what Obama said was, by the end of the year, we should be able to judge whether we're making progress. We're not saying that by the end of the year we'll be able to solve all the issues, but we're saying that by the end of the year we should be able to judge whether we're making progress or not. Okay, so obviously if you're not going to talk, you know, you can't test that. You can't have that process. And so then what are you going to do? You know, according to the people that are really concerned about Iran enriching uranium, I mean, I don't happen to be one of them, but if you are, you know, we have to sort of deal with the political reality that we face, which is that people in Washington think that it's a big threat to many people in Washington think that it's a big threat to the United States and humanity if Iran is allowed to enrich uranium, or at least if there's no kind of agreement between the United States and Iran about how and under what conditions Iran can enrich uranium. Well, so how are you going to get there? You know, you're going to have to talk. Again, at the end of the day, how are these issues going to be resolved? Are they going to be resolved by military force, which would be disastrous? Imagine, you know, we still have about 150,000 U.S. troops in Iraq, never mind Afghanistan. All the blowback that would come with a military attack, which even the Israelis can see, it's not going to end Iran's nuclear program, just going to delay it. So delay it till what? So you still have to face the question. As the Obama administration itself has said, you know, our issue, we have these issues with Iran that we want to address diplomatically, and they're not the issues that have been put on the world television screens in the last week. You know, democracy and human rights in Iran wasn't on the agenda. The agenda was Iran's nuclear program, Iraq, Afghanistan, Lebanon, and Palestine. So but you still have those issues no matter how this turns out. And the alternatives for dealing with those issues are still the disastrous option of military force, which won't solve the problems and probably make them worse, or a serious diplomatic engagement with Iran.
So whichever way you look at it, it's not going to be an easy time to figure out how much to say, because I noticed that the president was very careful as to what he has said in the past week or so. And as a matter of fact, he was attacked very forcefully for saying that it would really not make much of a change who emerges as the president of Iran as far as our negotiating with the country is concerned. And and he got there was a lot of concern about him saying that earlier on in the week.
It's true, but we should remember that there's a long tradition of these kind of opportunistic criticisms around the president's foreign policy. This happens in Democratic and Republican administrations by Democrats and Republicans. You know, when Bill Clinton was running as a presidential candidate in 1992, he attacked the then President Bush for coddling the Chinese, dictatorial Chinese regime. Then, you know, when he became president, what did he do? He coddled the dictatorial Chinese regime. So people kind of know this, you know, that this is kind of cynical opportunism around this stuff. It's easy for Republicans or talk show, you know, whatever, to say, oh, my God, you know, President Obama is bowing to the king of Saudi Arabia. He's kowtowing to the dictator in Iran. That's, you know, talk is cheap. At the end of the day, he's responsible for U.S. foreign policy. There is no good alternative to diplomatic engagement with Iran.
Okay, well, we shall see as things unfold. What do you expect, what is the next, are we expecting anything more from the Guardian Council? What's the next move here that you anticipate as far as this election, Iranian election is concerned?
Well, there have been some press reports, not really clear how, you know, with what basis they had, indicating that there is still opposition within the Guardian Council, within the Expediency Council, organized around Rafsanjani to certifying the election. That doesn't seem to be, though, the majority trend. It does seem to be the case that the Mehdi yesterday, that the government is consolidating and these events are winding down. And probably the best that can be hoped for at this stage is some kind of accommodation and opening inside the government, trying to integrate part of the opposition. It's hard to be too optimistic about that. But the other dynamic, I think, about which I feel a little more positive in the medium term, is the possibility that in the context of a sustained diplomacy between the United States and Iran that lowers international tension, it will change the political dynamics, where the U.S. serves as this bogey around which opposition is organized in Iran. That may lead to gradually to a thawing of political relations inside Iran.
Okay, so basically the regime has taken some blows, but it seems as if it might survive this this upheaval.
I would say much more likely than not that it will survive.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much. Robert Naiman is a senior policy analyst and national coordinator at Just Foreign Policy, and he wrote a piece just before the elections saying that based on Terror-Free Tomorrow poll, Ahmadinejad victory was expected. And it seems as if that has played itself out, and it's playing itself out in Iran right now. However, we don't know how much, we're watching. We're watching day by day to see how things unfold in Iran. Well, thank you so much, Robert Naiman, for joining us this evening and giving us an update on what is happening in Iran. And thank you for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Okay, take care now. Bye. This is 89.5 FM WPKN Bridgeport, 88.7 FM WPKM Montauk, and we shall continue in just with some more music, and then we'll be back at you.
بلادي جايين بلنا ناكل يا اخواني بانو عيب عيب شعب عيب عيب غير متحالو نرميك بلاد مراتش الوهيب وسمعو كل مراتش الريتون ما هاتلو غريبي هادي بلادي عايش فيها انا بالعلم ناوي فلو بلاد مراتش عمل هذا اللغة هاك تسمع بيت تسمع تسيدك ناوي هزبو اشتاق معانا تحير معانا اليوم كل شيء مع بلاد مراتش وجيتي انا ناوي معني واه معني واه ما تبقاش باخر كل كبيرات فكر فاتيرة مواليا تقناوا الدولة الأميرة بقي أفاق جيرة ما تبقاش واقف وتشوف الناس معصبة هاتي تعطل هاي هاتي تعطل بيشبة هاك معني هاك هاك مال يوما هاك هاك بلاك مرات هاك هاك شاف إصابة هاك هاك بيدي تقول هاك هاك من بلاج هاك هاك
شالا
It's 2 minutes before the hour of nine. This is 89.5 FM, WPKN Bridgeport. Good evening, I'm Eva Mudama. I'll be with you all the way until 10 o'clock tonight. Sitting in for Scott Harris, Counterpoint. I had lined up a number of topics to discuss today. Unfortunately, the people that I was going to interview didn't come through. I was going to talk about the Supreme Court ruling that leaves in place core provisions of the Voting Rights Act that came down today. And today, just an update on what happened in the court. Today, the Supreme Court in Northwest Austin Municipal Utility District Number 1 versus Holder rejected a challenge to the constitutionality of Section 5, the core provision of the Voting Rights Act. In an opinion authored by Chief Justice Roberts, the Supreme Court recognized the historic accomplishments of the Voting Rights Act are undeniable. Today's ruling, which was joined by seven other justices, recognizes Section 5's critical importance in addressing voting discrimination faced by citizens throughout our country. The entire thrust of NAACP Legal Defense Fund's argument was that the Section 5 remains critical to our democracy, and however grudgingly, the court acknowledges that in its opinion today, that is so. In an unusually harmonious opinion, today's decision upholds the constitutionality of an essential core protection in our democracy, said John Payton, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund's direct counsel. Payton observed that Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act protects and shields the rights of minority voters from discrimination. Section 5 has long been symbolic of our nation's long and unsteady march toward greater political equality. Without its protections, our nation would unnecessarily face the grave risk of significant backsliding and retrenchment in the fragile gains that have been made. And that is the ruling in the Supreme Court case today. And also across in Europe, on the other side of the Atlantic, the Zimbabwean Prime Minister, who was in Washington last week, is in London right now, and he met with the British Prime Minister Gordon Brown today, and they announced an extra £5 million, which is about $8 million of aid to Zimbabwe from Great Britain. And I saw something very interesting over the weekend. Zimbabwean Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai held a town hall meeting with Zimbabweans in London, and he couldn't get a word out. They were booing him from the very beginning and calling him a sellout for making this pact that they have right now, the unity government they have with Robert Mugabe. And the Zimbabweans in London didn't want to hear any of that. The agreement that was announced today of an extra £5 million, which is $8 million of aid to Zimbabwe, makes the total amount of aid from Great Britain to Zimbabwe £60 million, which is £98 million. And the British Prime Minister Gordon Brown said more money would only come after further reform. He said the aid would go through aid agencies, not the government, in which Tsvangirai shares power with President Robert Mugabe. Zimbabwe says it needs about $8 billion to revive its shattered economy. And Mr. Tsvangirai has been on a tour of Europe and the U.S. to ask for increased funding, but many donors are still wary of sending money which would be misused by Mr. Mugabe and his allies. Under Mr. Mugabe, relations between the U.K. and its former colony have become severely strained. Some $6.5 million of the new money is to be channeled into food aid and agriculture, with the rest towards buying textbooks for Zimbabwean schools. At the joint news conference in London, Mr. Tsvangirai defended his decision to share power with President Mugabe. Mr. Tsvangirai said irreversible change was now taking place in Zimbabwe toward a transition to democracy and elections. Mr. Brown said it was the first time a British and Zimbabwean prime minister stood together in Downing Street for 25 years. I pay tribute today to your courage, your determination, your strength of character, and your fortitude in this tragedy, he said. The British Premier added there are great signs of progress. A budget and economic plan are in place. Schools are reopening. Children are once again filling the classrooms. As a result of the progress, we will increase our support to help Zimbabwe move from mere survival towards genuine recovery. But he said further money would only be forthcoming if the reform program on the ground gains momentum. He called for more economic reforms, an improvement in human rights, media reform, the scrapping of repressive laws, and an end to the invasion of white-owned farms. This is according to a Reuters report. And now I'm going to play just a little bit of the news conference that was held today in London, Gordon Brown and Morgan Tsvangirai, the Prime Ministers of Great Britain and Zimbabwe.
Downing Street today, the first time that British and Zimbabwean Prime Ministers have done so for 25 years, and I pay tribute today to your courage, your determination, your strength of character, and your fortitude amidst tragedy. Let this meeting be a sign of our shared desire for change and of our shared commitment to delivering it. Let it also be a sign of my personal support for you, Prime Minister. The British government and the British people have always been friends of the people of Zimbabwe, even when our leaders have quarrelled. Zimbabwe's new government has set out for itself, in the new global political agreement, a clear roadmap for reform. Britain wants to help Zimbabwe meet these commitments. We want to see Zimbabwe prosper. We want to see the emergence of a free society and genuine democratic politics. And there are great signs of progress. A budget and economic plan are in place. Schools are reopening. Children are once again filling the classrooms. As a result of the progress, we will increase our support to help Zimbabwe move from mere survival towards a genuine recovery. I'm therefore very pleased today to announce that Britain's transitional support, our transitional support for Zimbabwe, will rise to £60 million, including an additional £4 million for food security to build Zimbabwe's resilience against future humanitarian shocks. We will also commit £1 million to provide textbooks for Zimbabwean children and address the dramatic shortage of materials in the newly reopened school. This aid will go directly to the people of Zimbabwe as both a response to immediate needs and as an investment in Zimbabwe's future.
And that was Zimbabwean Prime Minister, and actually it was Gordon Brown, the British Prime Minister, speaking there in a news conference that they held together. Now, I'm going to play something that happened over the weekend when Morgan Tsvangirai was booed when he went to speak to Zimbabweans living in London. He had a town hall meeting with Zimbabweans living in London, and they jeered him, and they wouldn't allow him to speak because they... he asked them to return to rebuild the country, and they said that they felt he was a sellout for getting involved in the unity government with Robert Mugabe.
What is our message to Zimbabweans in diaspora? Let me state here, and I'll state it boldly, that Zimbabwe must come home.
Led to Zimbabwean Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai walking away from the podium, and he was greeted by chants of "Mugabe must go," and he never got beyond the first sentence of his address. It's 11 minutes after 9, this is 89.5 FM, WPKN, Bridgeport.
Yeah. من ميوى عيب فيك انسأب حتى رأيت نفوى تعبوا فيك وفيا أسل عدنك سوا كيما بكيتيني اليوم قلعتيني الهموى
out of Africa. Niger's Electoral Commission has set parliamentary elections for the 20th of August, 2 weeks after the proposed date for a controversial referendum. President Mamadou Tanja dissolved parliament in May after a court ruled that his referendum plan was illegal. The referendum asked whether the president should be able to seek a third term. And which is what many African leaders tend to want to do, always looking for that third term when the Constitution says only two terms. Well, the Constitutional Court has twice ruled that the referendum cannot be held unless it is passed by Parliament. The BBC's Idi Barrow in the capital, Niamey, says it will be difficult for Mr. Tanja's supporters to gain the three-quarters of parliamentary seats they need to pass a referendum bill. One of the president's main allies, former Prime Minister Hama Akmadu, on Friday announced that he was forming his own party. Another party in his ruling coalition left 3 weeks ago over the third-term issue. The president has not yet publicly commented on the latest court ruling, which was made on the 12th of June. June 12th seems to be an interesting date, because June 12th was the infamously annulled election in Nigeria, was on June 12th, 1993. So June 12th. But our reporters say that that's the BBC reporters say that the state-controlled TV, which is seen as a government mouthpiece, has strongly condemned the ruling that banned the referendum scheduled for the 4th of August. Mumuni Amadou, chairman of the National Independent Electoral Commission, on Friday told Radio France International that the ruling was clear. It binds all public and military authorities. The CENI has therefore decided to head straight for an early legislative election, he said. Mr. Tanja was first elected in 1999. His supporters say he has brought economic growth and so has deserved the right to seek re-election. And I believe I know someone in the story. Mumuni Amadou is the chairman of the National Independent Electoral Commission in Niger. And if I have it correct, I believe he went to school right here in Bridgeport, Connecticut, at the University of Bridgeport. And interesting, we will be keeping an eye on what is happening in Niger with these elections and the seeking of a third term by the current president. And some news out of Somalia. Hardline Islamists have condemned four young Somali men to a double amputation for stealing mobile phones and guns. They will each have a hand and a leg cut off after being convicted by a Sharia court in the capital Mogadishu. The Al-Shabaab group has carried out amputations, floggings, and an execution in the port of Kismayo, but such punishments are rare in the capital. Al-Shabaab and its allies control much of southern Somalia and are battling the UN-backed government. Hundreds of residents attended the hearing in North Mogadishu. Armed Al-Shabaab militants were on guard while the accused were chained around their ankles. Three mobile phones and two assault rifles were displayed, which the accused had allegedly stolen. The defendants admitted the charges brought against them and were sentenced accordingly. Each one of them will have his right leg and right hand and left leg amputated publicly. Now, let's see. Your right hand and your left leg. Well, anyway, that's what the judge, Sheikh Abdallah Al-Haq, said. It is not clear where the leg will be cut. No dates were set for the punishment, which will be carried out after the health of the accused is assessed. I guess they'll assess your health before they cut off your limbs. Oh, well and good. Anyway, that is coming out of Mogadishu, Somalia. A really troubled part of the world.
Vide cloche, poche, vide baisse, fastoche. Mais la poisse s'accroche à face de mes textes. Je viens du bled, plein d'herbes dans les bagages. Ça, je tiens ma rage dans ma gorge. La plage déserte me pousse au cafard. Je traîne dans les bars, tard le soir où les soulards se filent au rasoir. Smith noir, dans le standard, je sombre dans le mégot trip égoïste. Chef de mes tripes, dans la musique Mars, ma ville un plateau. Où le désert avance un gâteau. Partagé à 10 méros, pendu à un lasso. Nourri au gaz de ville à la lumière orange. Comme elle, je dérange étranger aux pensées étranges.
Des odeurs de couscous couche de tagine de pruneau, de maria, sa poisson frais, pas de carbo, les épices me collent la peau. Assise là, les pieds dans l'eau, sous l'œil du préau. Ma ville s'éveille chaque matin quand les fourmis s'en vont au boulot. Fragile, un porte-à-faux, situation bancale, normale, tout le monde se barre. L'économie chaotique comme une guerre mécane, pluriethnique. Cohabitation naturelle, les cultures, les mœurs, les couleurs dansent comme dans une aquarelle. Seul du serval dévoile la face B de la carte postale. La tonne cache des nuages, un cercueil passe, mauvais présage. L'ennui vainqueur, pure peur devant les seringues de l'over. Le noir château, en fait sans un mot, Mars aspire au renouveau.
Saturday at 9, 89.5 FM, WPKN, Bridgeport. And also looking at some more news out of Africa. A case against the British government brought by veterans of the Kenyan independence struggle will be heard at the High Court in London tomorrow. Three men and two women have launched a compensation claim for alleged human rights abuses in the 1950s and 1960s. Thousands of people were rounded up and forced into camps by the British during what was known as the Mau Mau Uprising. The UK says the claim is not valid because of the amount of time since the abuses were alleged to have happened. I guess not so much. I guess there's a statute on limitations on human rights abuses. Anyway, the five Kenyans aged in their 70s and 80s are the lead claimants in the reparations case. They want the British government to acknowledge responsibility for atrocities in the pre-independence era and to compensate them. The government has indicated that the claim is invalid because of the time that has passed and that any liability rested with the Kenyan authorities after independence in 1963. An armed movement began in central Kenya during the 1950s with the aim of getting back land seized by British colonial authorities. Veterans of the war say they suffered barbaric treatment, including torture, as the British suppressed the rebellion. The Kenyan Human Rights Commission has said 90,000 Kenyans were executed, tortured, or maimed during the crackdown, and 160,000 were detained in appalling conditions. Historians say the Mau Mau movement helped Kenya achieve independence. So the case is to be heard in court tomorrow in London. We will be watching that and see where it leads.
Comme si je n'existais pas, elle est passée à côté de moi. Sans un regard, reine de Saba, j'ai dit Aïcha, prends tout est pour toi. Voici les perles, les
عايشه ونموت عليك. هادي سيد حياتي وحبي، انتي عمري وانتي حياتي. تمنيت ان عايش معك غير انتي. يوه عايشة عايشة هيك وتموى، عايشة عايشة انا نبغيك.
And out of Nigeria, we have news that militants in Nigeria's oil-producing region say they've blown up a major pipeline belonging to an Italian energy firm, AGIP. AGIP has not yet commented on the claims. A military spokesman denied that a pipeline had been hit, but said there had been skirmishes. He also denied the militants' claims to have disarmed 7 soldiers. Violence in the Niger Delta region has severely cut production in Nigeria, one of the world's main oil exporters. The Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta, MEND, has rejected the government's offer of an amnesty, although another militant leader, Atake Tom, has agreed to lay down his weapons. MEND has warned all foreign oil workers to leave the area. It says its latest attack took place in Niembe Creek in Bayelsa State, a pipeline supplying a crude oil to AGIP's brass exports terminal. Our fighters encountered a military gunboat, and all the soldiers numbering 7 were disposed of their weapons, dispossessed of their weapons. The gunboat was also stripped of its weapons before it was disabled by explosives, MEND said in an email sent to news organizations. If confirmed, this would be the second attack in Bayelsa State this week, after a pipeline belonging to Shell was blown up on Wednesday. Correspondents say the militants seem to be expanding their field of operations, as most recent attacks have been in neighboring Delta State. The military is currently pursuing a major offensive against the militants, which has caused thousands to flee their homes. MEND says they are fighting for the rights of local people to benefit more from their region's oil wealth. But correspondents say many criminal gangs have taken advantage of the unrest to steal oil and extort money from oil companies.
مفتوح البيبان وعلش الحرات على
WPKN Bridgeport, 88.7 FM, WPKM Montauk. And we're going to do this, and then we'll be right back.
This is John Laser, and I am the new technical director here at WPKN. As you know, we are 100% listener-supported and run by volunteers. We are looking for some creative technical volunteers from the community. We need your help redesigning our website so that it reflects who we are and gives us a more contemporary look and feel. If you are an experienced web designer and can help out your favorite radio station, please contact me at jl@wpkn.net or call me at 203-878-0260 during normal business hours. WPKN also needs newer PCs and networking gear to run our day-to-day operations and our on-air broadcasts. Have you recently upgraded your computer systems or have late-model PCs and/or networking gear that you're not using? If so, please consider donating them to WPKN. You may be eligible for a tax deduction since we are a 501c3 organization. Please contact me at jl@wpkn.net or call me at 203-878-0260 to arrange for pickup or drop-off instructions. Thank you for your support.
And that's WPKN's new technical director, John Lazar. And John, I believe, is coming in at 10 o'clock right here.
واللي ضارك هذي زعتو
Si te mueves como me fascina. si te mueves como me fascina.
Es que me fascina tu aroma, tu mirada. Pero lo que me gusta de ti es, tú sabes.
Yo, esto es fácil para nosotros. Esto sí es evolución. El Pony, JC, con DJ Maña.
El dueño del dembow.
El que pone la regla del juego. Canet Music, patrón, récord. A ver.
El Pony, debut single. Cuando tú me miras. And how about this news out of China? Google says it will take all necessary steps to remove pornography from its Chinese language portal, google.cn. The firm was responding to criticism from China's internet watchdog, which said Google was disseminating pornographic and vulgar information. Google has been warned twice about allowing unacceptable porn sites to be seen in search results. The news comes as China tries to make sure all new PCs sold in the country are fitted with filtering software. A popular outcry over the PC filtering plan prompted the Chinese government to clarify that although the surveillance software will ship with every computer, it does not have to be used. The Chinese government said its crackdown on Google and other major websites was to tackle the large volume of foreign internet pornographic information that has entered our borders, according to the Chinese. Google responded in a statement saying it had met with government officials to discuss issues surrounding its Google.cn service. We are undertaking a thorough review of our service and taking all necessary steps to fix any problems with our results, said Google's communications director, John Panetti, in a statement. China's Internet Illegal Information Reporting Center, CIRRC, said further action may be taken. According to CIRRC, 1,001 websites were blocked by authorities from distributing porn and other lewd material, and more than 4,000 other sites were also closed. At the end of 2008, the number of net users in China, which has a population of 1.3 billion, was almost the same as the entire population of the United States of America. So, talk about a growth area for the internet.
Kid, taken from the CD Sarah. Some funky, funky ride for you on a Monday night right here on 89.5 FM on the PKM Bridgeport. Nazgul is going to be taking over in about 3 minutes or so. I'd like to leave you with one more from Jeff Khalid. Welu, Welu. And a reminder that Scott Harris will be back here next week, next Monday. And it's been my pleasure sitting in for Scott. I had lined up a number of other interviews for this morning. Fortunately, we didn't get to them because we had some cancellations, but it's a good thing that we did an update on the situation in Iran. A little, slightly different take on what you hear on most media outlets. Jed Khalid from the CD Sarah.
Dejaste que saliera la tierra, me dejaste caer en tu abismo. De tus fotos, Shalfia Mabuhaya, Shalfia Mabuya. Me dejaste morir solo, dejaste que la noche me raptara.
inside. I kinda get the feeling like, you know when. Fell in love first time.
Ibang Ubama, the professor, is leaving the building to be brought back on Wednesday morning at 6 o'clock. And we wish him a safe and happy trip home. And you're listening to Nasmo Radio. Yes, John Laser is not here. I am in control. He is out earning a living and something that I should be doing. At least earning it. Anyway, so I'll be your host for the next 3 hours and 53 minutes, and you're listening to WPKN 89.5 FM, Bridgeport, Connecticut, as well as WPKM 88.7 FM, Montauk, New York. Some of you are listening to us on the World Wide Web at www.wpkn.org. You can even listen to us on iTunes. Click to your public radio. And then type in PKN, So you can take it in your car if you got one of those cars. And talking about cars, I was alerted by Mr. Laser that there is a Pontiac Banshee 833 1964 Circa in Napoli's indoor auto gallery, and that's on the south side of the road on US 1 in Milford, and it's a really unique and historic car. So those of you who are interested in that, the people there were very nice to me and let me walk around it, and wow, great. Now, talking about great is I am wearing my two birthdays ago birthday shirt that Hansen sent me, and I come in tonight and I've got a Woodstock Revival plates and napkins sent by Radio Art, who you can hear on WRUW at 7 o'clock to 8:30 on Saturday evenings, 91.1 FM out of Cleveland, Ohio. Well, that first one goes out to Radio Art because I happened to be in the library today, and I saw this, and it's Buffalo Springfield retrospective, and I said, wow, geez, I haven't played any of this in a while. And right in front of it in the return racks was J.J. Cale's Roll On. So I'll play some J.J. Cale, go to some Buffalo Springfield, then into, oh, G. Joan Baez, and I got some other things coming up. So I don't know what. I've got some history to read to you, and at 2 o'clock, we'll find out who comes in. So let's see if I get this right.